from Galatians chapter 5, verses 12 through 16. Galatians chapter 5, verses 12 through 16. As for those agitators, I wish they would go to the whole way and emasculate themselves. You, my brothers, were called to be free, but do not use your freedom to indulge a sinful nature. Rather, serve one another in love. The entire law is summed up in a single command. Love your neighbor as yourself. If you keep on biting and devouring each other, watch out, or you will be destroyed by each other. So I say, live by the Spirit, and you will not gratify the desires of sinful nature.
Let me begin by welcoming everyone that's here. We have several visitors in our midst. We have several of our regular people that are away, but we have several visitors, and we're glad you're here. Some of you, a couple of you at least, might be here for the first time. But nonetheless, several that are here, and as I said in the bulletin this morning, I want to encourage you to meet them, greet them, welcome them here, and let them know that we really do want them to come back and be with us. As Edward said, and I really appreciate the songs that he chose this morning, and Tom did last Sunday morning, the songs have been fantastic for this short two-lesson series on love. And as Edward said, this morning I'm going to really look at some descriptions of love. I'm going to use an alliteration just to kind of sum up everything that is said, or at least a lot of things that are said in the Bible about love. And that'll become very clear as I start going through the slides. But if you remember last week, the passage Kevin just read for us, we closed with that, and I told you a story that kind of sticks with me, and I guess somewhat haunts me, about a young lady, and she would be middle-aged now, but that I knew over 20 years ago, and one who had responded to the gospel, and very quickly, as Galatians 5 talks about, the King James uses the term to bite and devour. Very quickly, because of the indiscretion of an older member of the church who tried to force his advances upon her, she left the faith, and to my knowledge, has never come back. And her lasting impression was that Christians, religious people, members of the Church of Christ, whatever, are just hypocrites. No one really believes this stuff that we claim we believe. And you have to understand how she came from a background where there was not a lot of love in her life and not a lot of love in her family. She thought she had found that, only to have that destroyed by, as I say, someone doing, of course, what he shouldn't have been doing. And that stays with me. I want it to stay with you. And no doubt, you know of, if not the same kind of thing, at least similar things, where someone, because of their lack of care, their lack of concern for another person, has really harmed, if not destroyed, the faith of another individual. That doesn't make them, it doesn't mean they're not responsible to God. And I tried to say that to her over the contact that I maintained, really, for the next couple of years. You are still responsible to God, regardless of what someone does. Everyone is not like that. But in her mind, she had a rough childhood, and that was just the final straw. So I want you to kind of keep that in mind as we look at some things this morning. Jesus said, and we looked at this last time, Edward just emphasized this in some songs, love one another as I have loved you. The new commandment is the qualifier that Jesus places upon Leviticus 19. Love one another as I have loved you. And greater love has no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. Of course, you find that in John 15. Now, this morning, as I said, as I said, I want to use this alliteration as we describe biblical love. When you look in the New Testament, I think I said this last Sunday, I'm not sure, but I believe I did. In the New Testament, there are different words for love. Yes, I'm sure I did last Sunday. There are different words for love. The Greek language is a very rich language. And as I said last Sunday, we love pizza and we love our wives. And we use the same word for everything in between and for all kinds of things. The Greek language was very rich, and it used different words for different kinds of love, if you will, or different expressions of love. And there were a number of those terms, three of which occur in the New Testament. So if you want to understand it, and I could get up here and go through those different words and exactly what they mean, I'm not going to do that. What I'm rather going to do is describe what the Bible teaches us about love. And as I said, I want to use this alliteration. So I'll have six things, six little circles up here, and I'm going to go through them and spend just a few minutes on each one. But if I would say, what is the New Testament teaching us? What is the Bible teaching us about love? Well, basically, love is caring. We see that from God, beginning with God. We love Him because He first loved us. The last song we just sang emphasizes 1 John 4 and verse 19. God cares. God cares the condition we're in, the state we're in when we sin. God could leave us to that. He would be just in doing that. But love is caring. God is love, and love is caring. God cares about us. So when we begin to look at the New Testament, we run across passages like Galatians 6. You might want to turn to verses 1 and 2. Here's one of those passages that speaks to the idea of you caring about someone else. Brethren, Paul says, if a man be overtaken in a fault, and here's the idea of being lost. It was a military term for someone who had gone down the wrong pass or whatever it might be and was literally lost in the mountains. If a man be overtaken in a fault, you which are spiritual, restore such a one. That is, go get him. Bring him back on the right track. Help him. Bear, verse 2, bear one another. Carry one another's burdens and so fulfill the law. The idea of love is a fulfilling of the law. The essence of everything we see in the Bible, from Genesis to Revelation, is God saying to us, I care, so you care. Don't be an uncaring, selfish individual. Be the kind of person who cares about someone else and the condition they're in. We see passages like James 2, and I want you to turn there and read this one with me. Now, this is not a passage you haven't heard before, but think about exactly what's being expressed here. Do you care when someone else is suffering? In James 2, notice this. What does it profit, my brethren? Now, he's asking you about your faith, asking me about my personal faith. He says, what does it profit, my brethren, though a man say he has faith and he has not works? Can faith save him? And the answer, the rhetorical question, the answer to it is obviously no, faith cannot. Now, if you were to ask people, will faith save you? I suppose that if you ask 100 religious people and you say, will faith save you? 100 out of 100 will say yes. But it will not, separate and apart from the expression of that faith. It's not an academic exercise to come to God and live the life of a Christian. We make it that way sometimes. We think sometimes, you know, as long as I believe what's in this book and I'm willing to fight for it, you know, that somehow makes me a faithful Christian, I'm faithful to God, I will be saved by God. That's not what the Bible is teaching. The Bible is teaching us that love is caring, and it has to be put into action. Notice this. Can faith save you? No. If a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you say unto them, depart in peace, be warmed and filled. I like to put it like this. You know, what we say in this day and time, and we're quick to pat someone on the back or shake their hand and say, I hope everything works out for you. And if you've been a person that's been in need, and I'm sure some of you have, and I mean real need, but if you've ever lived during a time where you didn't know where you were going to sleep, and you didn't know where you were going to get food, and I don't mean just at lunch, I mean today or tomorrow, and if something happens to the clothes on your back, you don't know where those are coming from. And I'll say lastly, if you've ever been in a position sitting alone somewhere, for example, under an overpass on a culvert, and you had to say to yourself, right now, I don't know anyone who cares enough about me to even come looking for me, much less take care of me. Now, if you've ever been destitute, it doesn't help a whole lot for someone to say, I hope everything works out all right for you. Now, that's what James is describing here. Love is not well-wishing. Love cares. God is not looking down at us and saying, you know, Michael, I hope you get everything worked out in your life. I'm not doing anything for you. But I hope you get it all fixed. If you do, come on up to heaven and live with me forever. That's not love. So James says, one of you would say unto him, depart in peace, be warmed and filled. Notwithstanding, you give them not those things which are needful to the body. What good is it? What does it profit? Love is caring. And so we think of passages like the golden rule that we find in Matthew 7 and verse 12. Now someone has paraphrased this to say, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Again, when we're in trouble, when we have needs, etc., we want someone to care, and we want someone to take care of those needs. Well, if that's what you feel, then know that other people feel that and care enough to reach out to those people. Love is caring. Finally, look at Matthew chapter 25. Do you remember the story of the judgment, the great judgment scene? The longest passage about the judgment in the Bible. I don't know if you've ever really thought about that, but the longest one about Judgment Day you find in the book of Matthew. And in part of that, in Matthew 25, when we see the actual appearing of Jesus in verse 31, the Bible describes Jesus dividing the sheep from the goats. The Bible says that Jesus will then look at a group of people and say, come, you blessed. You can see this down in verse 34. Come, you blessed of my Father. Inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you fed me. I was thirsty, you gave me drink. I was a stranger, you took me in. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited, or you took care of me. I was in prison, you came unto me. And then the righteous will say to him, when did we do that? You know, I don't know about you, but Jesus ain't never come walking down my street. So when did we do that? And Jesus makes the point. When you did it for the least of these, my brethren, look at it in verse 40. You've done it unto me. Love is caring. Jesus says, if I was there, that's what I would do. You go and do likewise. If I saw someone hungry, I wouldn't pass by on the other side of the road kind of waving at them and say, I hope you get something to eat. I would feed them. I would take care of them. I would see to their needs. Now, the point in both of these passages, in all of these passages like this, is you see them. They're in your corner of the world. They become your responsibility to try to do something. And you'll notice likewise, and I won't take time to read all of it, but Jesus then will turn to another group of people and say, verse 41, depart from me into everlasting fire. Why? Because I was hungry and you didn't feed me, etc., etc. You didn't care. Love is caring. Naturally, you might say, love is creative. You know, it's not just that I have a responsibility to feed the person that's dying on my front porch. Okay? Love is creative. God is creative. The Pharisees, if we turn to them on the other hand, they sort of affirm a list. When you think of the man, and I'm not going to turn there, but I'm sure you know this story well in Luke 18. Remember the parable of the Pharisee and the publican? And Jesus talked about two distinctly different individuals. One of them that was acceptable to God, he talked about last, and that was the publican, the tax collector, who went out and wouldn't even lift up his eyes to heaven, but in humility he beat himself on the chest and he said, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. But the Pharisee had a list, and he proclaimed that list before God. He told God, you know, I fast twice a week. I do this, I do that. I check off the list, and so therefore, I know I'm fine. I'm right. And not only that, but he had another list of what he did not do. I don't do this, and I don't do that, and I'm not even like that filthy publican over there. Now, what is in your heart? Love is creative. You know, when you think about it in the New Testament and what it teaches, love disposes us to creatively seek opportunities. You want to do for others. Why? You want to go looking for things to do. Why? Because it's what your master would do if he were here. And in fact, it is what your master says he does through you. It creates opportunities to love other people. It wants to express its love. Now I ask you, think about someone you really love. If that is a child, and I think that becomes the easiest one to think of. If that is a spouse, a boyfriend, a girlfriend, a best friend, you know, one of these, what is it, BFF, BFFL, whatever that is. Whatever it is, you know. But if it's one of those people, think about someone you really, really love. And think about the fact that God has created us to be expressive with our love. We want to love. How many women have I talked to over the years, especially young women, who want desperately to get married? And they want to have a child. And they begin to talk about that, and they begin to tell you because they want to love. It's in their nature to give that love. God has made us that way. God has created us. I think that if you were to ask me, there are a lot of things that I wanted to do in life. I wanted to accomplish, close your ears, by the way. I wanted to accomplish in life. But what I wanted to be more than anything else, and especially the older I got, was a father. God has created us to want to express our love. So we look for those opportunities. That's why we have children. Did anybody in here that had children, did you have the child not knowing how much work that was going to be? How much trouble? How many sleepless nights? How many times they were going to get sick and depend on you, etc., etc.? But you want to express that love. Love doesn't ask, have I done enough? Like the Pharisee praying to God, not only have I, but I know I have done enough. Love goes beyond that and asks the question, what more can I do? Read this one passage with me in Philippians chapter 1, and let's talk about this for just a second, and we'll make a point here. Over the last, I don't know how many number of years, as you start to put all of this stuff, you know, together and kind of get this whole story in your mind, this passage has really stuck out to me. And I listen to Paul here when he says in verse 21, for me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. Now, you know, when you get older, and I figure that I'm a little over halfway through life, so I don't look at myself as, you know, ready to go and all of that kind of thing, but I am older. And I don't feel about things the way I once did. I'm more tired now than I ever was before. When I get through the end of a day, I'm ready for bed more than I ever used to be. You know that feeling. A lot of you do. And I think what Paul is saying here is, if I died, in many respects, that would be gain to me. I would profit from that. To live is Christ, to die is gain. But notice verse 22. But if I live in the flesh, this is the fruit of my labor. This is what I get out of my work, we would say. Yet what I choose, I don't know. For I am in a strait betwixt the two. Now what does that mean? Well, you got between a rock and a hard place. Two hard choices. I have a desire to depart. If you were to ask Paul at this time, Paul, what would you rather happen? He'd rather die. And he's not being morbid about it. He just would rather die. He's tired. He's ready to go. He would rather die. I'd rather die and be with Christ, which is far better. Nevertheless, to abide in the flesh, to remain in the flesh, is more needful for you. Let me ask you a question. If you look at 2 Corinthians chapter 11, and you read that list, in fact, was it Camel Lynch that brought up that Thursday night in 2 Corinthians 11? If you read that list there, is 25 years of hard work, beatings, imprisonments, injustices, dangers, shipwrecks, etc., etc., as Paul goes on to say there in the mid-50s, being just worn out, in pain, suffering, doing without, is that enough? And add to that anxiety and the anxiety of taking care of all these congregations, of being a surrogate spiritual father to all these people, is 25 years of that enough? You know, Paul could easily have said, I've done enough. And if you look at Philippians 1, you could easily, if he'd just written this slightly differently, what it would be saying is, I really want to die, God, because I've done enough. But he doesn't feel that way, does he? Oh, part of him does, sure. He's tired. But there's another part of him that says, I need to be here, don't I? People count on me, don't they? I need to live. And so to abide in the flesh is more needful for you. In fact, by the time of Philippians, it had been about 30 years of this kind of hardship. And he was currently in prison, having gone through yet another shipwreck, yet another injustice, yet another hard time, etc., etc. Love doesn't say, have I done enough? Love says, what more can I do? Love is compelling. And it really goes very well with the last point we just made. Love forces you. You don't say, what do I have to do, in the sense of, I don't really want to. But you feel compelled to do more because you love. You ask things like, what is the best thing I can do for everybody concerned? Now I ask you something, and be honest with me. You think that's the way most people are? You think most people live their lives asking themselves what is best for everybody that's involved in my life and everybody that's even involved in this situation? Or do you think most people live their lives by what do I want and the rest of you live with it? I think we see the latter. And it's very sad when you think about that, because that's not love. Love asks, what's the best thing for everybody concerned? Love makes choices based on everyone benefiting. Everyone's life being better. Mine included, but everybody's life being improved. What will be of the most benefit? In fact, when we look in the Bible, we see passages like 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 14. Love constrains me. By love I am constrained to do such and such, so and so. It forces, it compels my behavior. It doesn't merely allow it. In fact, look with me at 1 Corinthians 9. And if you want to, kind of stay in this section of 1 Corinthians, because I'm going to touch on it a couple of times here. But look at something Paul said down in 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 16. Now we'll come back to this passage. But just to pick up the principle in verse 16. Paul said, for though I preach the gospel, I have nothing to glory of, for necessity. Now listen to that. Compulsion is laid upon me. Yea, woe is unto me if I don't preach the gospel. Why did Paul preach? Was it for glory? No. Was it for people to appreciate him? No. Was it for people to tell him how brilliant he was, etc., etc.? No. Paul was preaching the gospel because something deep down inside him said, you have to. You just have to preach. And he could not have lived without preaching. Now, have you ever been in a situation, it doesn't have to be preaching. It can be anything, any good thing that you do that's going to cost you. You're going to have to sacrifice to do it. You're going to have to give up some things in order to do it. And if you've ever been in one of those situations, you know exactly what Paul is saying. Because if someone said, why do you do that? And you say, I have to. It's just something inside me and I have to do it. That's what love is. It compels you to make a move to do something because it is what you have to do. Turn a page or so over to chapter 10 and verse 23. That's why Paul would make a statement like this. In fact, he makes several of them like this in this section. All things are lawful for me. Now, here's the idea of what am I allowed to do? What can I do? What will God let me do? All things are lawful for me, but all things are not expedient. It's not profitable. It's not the best, and it's not the best for everyone concerned. All things are lawful for me, but all things edify not. You know, when we do things in life, let's just be honest. A lot of things we do in life, now some things just don't matter one way or the other. But a lot of things we do in life either build up or they tear down. And you make choices as a responsible Christian based on the effect or the outcome of what you do. You ask yourself, before you just jump and do what you do, and let the chips fall where they do, and everybody get hurt as they're going to, you ask the question, will this build up? Will it build my life up? Will it build the people I care about? Will it build them up? Will it build that other individual or individuals who are involved? Will it build them up? Or will it tear us all down even further? Paul said, you know, There are a lot of things that I can do, and I have a right to do, but it's not what's best. Love forces you to ask what is best for everyone concerned. And love is comprehensive. Love is inclusive. And love is indiscriminate. I love this old poem. An older lady gave me this, the first place I ever preached, and told me about a poet named Edwin Markham. I'd never heard of him, and I certainly had never heard this poem. But part of it goes, and this is a little poem called Outwitted. He drew a circle that shut me out, and it speaks of people who would close you out or shut you out of their life. He drew a circle that shut me out, heretic, rebel, a thing to flout. But love and I had the wit to win. We drew a circle that took him in. That's love. Isn't that what God does? Wes was talking about Thursday night in a Bible study. The rain falls on the just and the unjust. The sun shines upon both. And there are many blessings in life where God just puts an umbrella and in fact takes people in. You have to admit, you have to, if you're honest, and I know life can stink. I understand that. But you have to be honest and you have to admit there still are, no matter how bad things get, there still are some good things in life. Why are they good? Why are we not, if evolution is the progenitor of us all, why are we not just a bunch of animals, uncaring animals? Why are we not just a bunch of self-centered, and some people say we are, you know? But no, we're not. No, you can still find people to help. Let a tragedy come, the Boston Marathon immediately comes to mind. Bombs go off. People are literally laying there with arms and legs blown off. And you know, you don't know in a situation like that how many bombs are going to come. And yet people rushed to those people. Why? Animals don't do that. Throw a grenade in a pack of wolves and watch what they do when it goes off. They scatter in every direction and they don't care. You reflect the nature of God. There's something inside of you that says, go help because I would go help. And I made you. Love is comprehensive. And situations like that force you to know that you really deep down inside, you don't care what that person is. I mean, there's no room for prejudice in love. The Bible says it like this, there is neither, and it lists a number of things there, including even gender. The point is, there is no room for prejudice on the basis of color. Tragedies like that make you realize that. You're not rushing to that group of people that are hurt and in your mind thinking, let me sort them out before I get there. If they're black, I ain't touching them. If they're white, I ain't helping them. You don't do that. You don't care about color and you don't care about station. You don't ask how rich or poor, what position they hold or don't. And you don't care about ethnicity. You don't care if a person came from England or America or Uganda or wherever it might be. You just don't care. And finally, you certainly don't care if they're male or female. Something inside you says, help. And you run to help. You do what you can. You do it because you love. And deep down inside of you, put there by God, is the capacity to love. You are created in the image of God. And love is, and I struggle what term to put here. This is the one I wanted to put, and I thought, well, that sounds so weird, but I decided I'm going with it anyway. Love is correlative. It is correlated, if you will. It originates in and it is built in a community. In other words, you don't love in a vacuum. God didn't put you here in this world without other people. And really, God would teach us, as much as we might, some of us like sometimes, you know what I'd really like to do? I don't want to hear another siren. I don't want to hear another person scream or yell or curse. I don't want to see another person drive. What I would really like to do is find me a mountain somewhere with nobody there. And live. That's not the way God made us. I mean, you can get away for a few days, rest your mind, and come back. But God didn't make you that way. God made us to love within a community. Love builds the community. Love cares about the community. Even the church is a community. And we see that in the New Testament. And so you share in the needs and the concerns of the fellow members of the church. In other words, you enjoy fellowship. And that's what fellowship means, to share. And of course, to share in the needs and the concerns, etc., the weepings and the joys and so forth and so on of fellow members. In fact, in the New Testament, again, love edifies. It builds the house. It builds the community. I'm not going to turn to a lot of these passages. But just think about what Colossians 2 and Ephesians 4 talk about. The idea, and some of you in my class downstairs, you've seen these passages. We've emphasized them, especially this past quarter. And the idea of every joint, every part of the body contributing to the whole. Paul's analogy in 1 Corinthians 12. We are baptized into one body, but we are members individually. Members in particular. And we contribute what we have to the good of the whole. The community needs what I have. And I need what it has. And so I might, in my life, with my talents, my abilities, etc., I might be classified, to use Paul's analogy, as a foot. And I can do a good job being a foot, but I can't be an eye. A foot cannot see. I need the fellow members of the community, and they need me. You know, the foot can't see where it's going without the eye, but the eye can't go anywhere without the foot. We need each other. And when we understand that and we come together as a community and we share what we have and build each other up with that, well, then we become strong, a body of Christ, a fully functioning body of Christ. And that's why, just like the song says, I love thy kingdom, Lord. I love the way you've designed it. I love what you've done and what you've created in this world. And yes, going back to the original story that I ended with and began again today, if I could have made this young lady understand that. That yes, there are body parts that become diseased sometimes and even have to be cut off. But that doesn't mean that the body is not a good thing. You can be part of a body, and there are people who care. You know, sadly enough, going back to that story, the last thing I'll say about it. But she was coming, you know, not just a member of that church and not just living in that home, if you remember the story from last Sunday. But she was coming to a weekly Bible study that we held with a group of people there who loved her very much. And when she stopped coming and wouldn't have anything to do with us anymore, I mean, it hurt. And what I tried to say to her was, you're losing so much. So much help, so much that will be there for you in this life. And you have so much to offer. And she did. Very bright, talented young lady. You hate Satan for things like that. And I truly do. Finally, love is cross-bearing. I mean, it is sacrificial, is the idea. You know, love looks at life and says, will I sacrifice? I don't want to give up this. I don't want to give up that. Now, I'm going to digress for a moment. I think our society right now, where we are right now, doesn't mean that it's because it's America. There have been times in America, and there are times still. And it doesn't mean that everybody is totally selfish. I think times just like in Boston a few weeks back proved that. But I believe that what we're taught and shown by example is, from other people, is you just be selfish. You think about you. If you don't think about you, nobody else will, right? I mean, that's what we hear. Well, is that true? If you don't think about you, no one else will. I'm not convinced that's true. There are good people out there who will think about you, who will care, and who would even be willing to sacrifice. I think there are people, and I think if you give them a chance, that there are certain people that you can go to and you can say, will you do this for me? I need help with this or that. And there are plenty of people out there still who will sacrifice what they're doing and they will do that for you. Not everyone. And if you've met some selfish people, a whole lot of them lately, join the club. But there still are people who reflect the nature of God. Bottom line is, that's what I need to do. I need to be like Jesus. Think back to Judgment Day. You come to heaven. Why? Because you knew somebody was hungry and you fed them? Wow. You mean, God, that means that much to you that I'm willing to give up my little bit of money, I'm willing to give up my little bit of time, I'm willing to do something like that? It really makes a difference on how you feel about me? Yeah. Or on the other hand, you know somebody is hungry and you don't care. Or you have a list. I go to church, I take the Lord's Supper, I give this number, you know, this percentage of my money. I do this, I do that, I do the other thing, and I tell God about it. As if to say, you owe me, Jesus. And when Jesus comes, Jesus is going to look at me and say, forget your list. You know? I ask for sacrifice. Greater love has no man than this, that a man laid down his life for his friends. That's what I gave. Love one another as I have loved you. You see, love doesn't just say, what are my rights? What are my... I'm so sick and tired of hearing about people's personal rights. I don't know about you, but I am sick. I'm disgusted with hearing about personal rights. I have the right to do this, and I have... What about everybody else? Love doesn't scream, give me my rights. Love screams, what can I give up for the good of everyone else around me? Love doesn't say, is it lawful? Is it legal for me to do it? Does somebody give me approval to go do this thing? Love, in turn, says, is it what's best? Is it expedient? Will it help the most if I do this thing? Or will it hurt? That's love. In 1 Corinthians chapters 8 through 10, and no, I'm not going to take the time to read all that, so you breathe a little sigh of relief. But you might want to go home and read it. And scan it with me for a moment. Look back at chapter 8. Paul starts off by talking about, because they had apparently asked him about things sacrificed to idols. And they were divided over that. They're fighting over that. One group looked at it and said, you know, if you go to the marketplace and you buy a piece of meat that's been sacrificed, an animal sacrificed to idols, well, that's just wrong. It's wrong. It's dead wrong. And another group of people said, an idol is nothing, so it doesn't matter. They were fighting. And Paul comes to these Christians and says, wait a minute, guys. Love doesn't dispose you to scream what's right, what's wrong, only that. Might say, wait a minute, Michael, you know, you have to be concerned with what's right and wrong. That's wrong. You do. But there are plenty of things in life that you can label right and wrong that hasn't answered the whole question. Do I have a right to go downtown and buy a piece of meat that's been sacrificed? Well, the Roman government would say, you have that right. And your own conscience would say, you have that right. And a lot of other people would say, you have that right. And some people would say, but it's wrong. And some of these people who would say it is wrong are young, inexperienced, don't know any, just don't have the knowledge to know any better. Do you care? And that's what Paul is saying to them. Do you care? Do you care what they think? Do you care how they feel? Do you care if their faith will be destroyed? Because if you don't care, then none of this makes any sense. And when you go on into chapter 9, Paul starts off, you notice verse 1. Am I not an apostle? Am I not free? And he begins to talk about what he has a right to do and what he could do if he chose. I could be married if I chose to do that. I choose not to be so I can give all my time to God. Who does that? A Christian. Person does that. Paul goes on to talk about a lot of rights that he has. In fact, it's not just meat sacrificed to idols. Notice the section begins in verse 19. Though I be free from all men, I've made myself servant to all. Why would you enslave yourself to other people? Notice what Paul says, that I might gain the more. And he even lists a lot of people here who had a lot of diverse beliefs. There were weak people and there were Jewish people. There were people from all stations of life and all ethnic backgrounds. And you have to be concerned with that. Why? Because it's not just about your personal rights. And it's not just about what you may be allowed to do by the government or even by the Lord. You have to be concerned with what is best. And so Paul would say in this passage, I do this, verse 23, for the gospel's sake that I might be partaker thereof with you. Again, there's that idea of I want to take you in. I want to embrace you. I want us to be Christians together. Not just I want to get mine. And then when you go to chapter 10, again, verse 23, this, all things are lawful for me, but all things are not expedient. Notice as Paul goes down and it closes this out, verse 32. Give no offense, neither to the Jews, nor to the Gentiles, nor to the church of God. Now when he says offense, he means what will cause another person to stumble in their faith. Be guided by that. I will never hurt nor destroy the faith of another individual, no matter what. No matter what I have to give up, no matter what it costs me, I will not deliberately do something that will destroy another person's faith. And Paul would even say in chapter 8, if it means I never eat meat again, I would go that far. Verse 33. Even as I please all men in all things. And here's the line I want you to take away from this. This is love. Not seeking my own profit, but the profit of many, that they may be saved. That's love. That's what guided Jesus. Why did Jesus die? Did he want to? Did he want to be brutalized, Bill? Did he want to suffer? Did he want to do all those things? Did he want to do it? No. Father, take this cup from me. If it's possible, I don't want to do it. Nevertheless, just like Bill said, not my will, but yours be done. But what forced him to that? What moved him to that? Why would he do that? He lost his life. We gained ours. He did that for the profit of many, that we might be saved. You go do the same, and you'll love truly. If you're here today and you're not a Christian, you believe in the Lord. You believe in Jesus, that He gave everything and died for you, and you'll confess He's the Son of God who demonstrated the love of God in what He did. I want to change my life. I want to live like Jesus lived. I want to be like Him in every respect. I have sins. I know I've done things, plenty of things that are wrong. And I believe if I'm baptized, those things will be washed away because that's what the Lord says. I wash those things away by my blood. And you have a clean life, clear of everything. And I want to live a life for the Lord, be right with Him always. Because when He comes back on Judgment Day, I want to be acceptable to Him. Maybe you're here this morning, you've been baptized long ago even. But you look at your life and you say, I haven't been what I need to be. I realize that. I realize how far short I've fallen of that. And I want to confess that and ask people to pray for me because I want to be right with God.